Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Notable.
We thought bring the podcast to Timber Festival because it seemed like a fitting way to end the series / season. So I'm going to leave you in the very capable hands of the magnificent Elizabeth Alker, Stuart McConey.
Is someone brewing beer? Get a really strong smell of hops. Oh, what are these things behind?
It's the herbs, I think.
Oh, maybe
it's got a little herb garden.
You know, like when you used to get off at Manchester Victoria and the smell of the Boddington's brewery would hit you. It's like that. Anyway, notable, we're interested in all kinds of music, aren't we?
We are. Mm.
And notable, and like kind of social history and stuff like that. So notable is a bit of fun, really. It's a labour of love that's become a podcast thing where we talk about interesting musical stories from any genre of music, any era. What sort of things have we talked about in the two seasons thus far?
We've talked about the development of the theremin.
We have.
Russian spy turned theremin engineer. We've talked about a medieval murderous madrigal composer.
We have, Kujeswaldo. We've talked about the copper who used to knit...
It's a fun night out with those.
It is. The copper Norman Pilcher who used to arrest... drug-addled 60s pop stars and became immortalised as Semolina Pilcher in I Am the Walrus.
Yeah, Elvis and his one appearance on UK shores.
Elvis is one time in the UK. Yeah. Anything that's a little bit quirky.
Yeah.
And so we're going to call it a halt for the summer because Elizabeth spends the summer in Monte Carlo, whereas I help out with underprivileged kiddies in the Wigan area all summer. So we're going to finish with this. We're going to record a little chat we're going to have now.
Before I get my flight.
Before Elizabeth goes to Swaddling Cut International Airport for a flight to Monte Carlo, Monica. And we're going to talk, this will be the last one of this series. And if you don't know it,
Yeah, we've done about 16
We've done about 16.
It's Jeff keeping count. We've done more. How many? 18.
18 says producer Jeff.
Gosh, we've been working so hard.
I know, and we've made about 25 quid.
Yeah. we haven't made that much.
People keep telling me.
Beer money.
Yeah, no, but that's not... We think we're in it for the long haul, but we're going to take a summer break.
Yeah.
And we thought while we were here, two fitting subjects just to chat loosely about for 40 minutes or so.
We're going to talk about the history of music festivals or music in public gatherings.
And then a bit about the Voyager Golden Record, which I don't know if you know about. Which even now is on board Voyager, a 12-inch single, making its way through the galaxy to tell other human beings, to tell alien life, should it find it, what human
about
culture
us.
And society and history was all about. We'll come back to that in a minute.
Yeah, so you said 40 minutes, but actually I'm starting by going to the 7th century BC. So
wow.
I don't know how long
I like
we've
this.
Actually
come
got.
With us now.
No, I'm going to rattle through the next, I don't know, well, the last 10,000 years.
Okay.
So the Pan-Hellenic Games. This is the first or the earliest kind of recorded example of music at big festivals or public events. The Olympics are part of the Pan-Hellenic Games, you may know. They were a 4-year cycle of games, of sports, athletic competition. And the Greeks marked time by the games. So the Olympics kicked it off. It was a 4-year cycle. And then in the third year, were the Python Games, and these were, each of the games was kind of dedicated to an ancient Greek god. The Python Games were dedicated to Apollo, who was the god of archery, poetry, dance, healing, light.
There you go.
And music, portfolio career.
Yeah.
Good old Apollo had. And so because he was the god of music, the games would have like lots of kind of festivities that involved music and dance and that sort of thing. There was a vine procession, so people would bring vines into Athens, and it was all very nice and musical. Abolished in AD 393 by the Roman emperor at the time, because, of course, it was heathen, because they were all kind of celebrations of the gods. So that's kind of the earliest example of it. I've been tracing this back. The word festival actually means religious holiday. The Latin is festa. It's where we get the word feast from, and fates as well, village fates. So it's kind of impossible to trace the full history of festivals. But I was looking at kind of where the roots of a lot of the festival traditions that we have in the modern contemporary pop festival as we know it today, where they lie. And actually, a big influence on the way we do festivals now is from Nordic countries and during the Middle Ages. So lots of pagan rituals around the solstice, which is why we have that sort of vibe in our festivals today. So obviously the solstice, a big thing in Nordic countries because they get up to like 21 hours of daylight.
Yeah.
We've been to Iceland, haven't we? Oh, it was the opposite though when we were there.
No, we brilliantly went to Iceland in the middle of the winter where it's light for 20 minutes. Yeah. It came light at 11 o'clock in the morning, didn't it? It was dark again about lunch after dinner. Yeah,
It gave us like an hour to skid around in our Doc Martens.
That's right,
Pub. So, yeah, so lots of kind of solstice traditions in Nordic countries around that time, the 23rd of June. And a lot of the kind of hallmarks of those festivities we still see in festivals today. So in Sweden, it's a big thing. This was like a time when young girls would go and try and meet their husband. So flower wreath wearing became a big thing in Sweden at that time, which we still see today.
Looking around now to see if anyone's come.
There were some flashing flower wreaths, which are amazing. I was hoping they might be here, but last night I saw some that actually lit up. They were incredible.
Well, they still are very much festival wear then, aren't they?
They are, yeah. As is trapping off.
Wow.
Like the girls in Sweden were at the time. So, you know, still...
trapping off. technical term there, Jeff. You'll have to put a glossary in for this podcast.
So, yeah, in Sweden, this was a big thing. The girls would kind of dress up. There was maypole dancing. Apparently, if they put 7 flowers under their pillows, then on Midsummer Night's Eve, so the 23rd of June, they would dream of their husband. And that was the kind of... That was the myth. It doesn't work. In Norway, bonfires were traditional, as we still see that now. Over here, we just kind of blew it wide open because we didn't have that kind of, the divinities that they had in ancient Greece and in, Norse mythology.
Yeah.
So we had fairies and unicorns and dragons and things like that, and we still see that in the British festival tradition. There are echoes of that, aren't there?
Yeah, I've seen unicorns at Glastonbury load.
Around the stone circle.
Yeah, just generally in the chip van queue everywhere,
I'm sure there are people who've been to Glastonbury and think they've seen a unicorn.
Exactly.
In Russia, skinny dipping was a big thing. Fertility was a big thing with a lot of these kind of Nordic rituals. Just to step away from Europe for a second, in the 19th century, the Rio Carnival is a really kind of quite early example.
Has that been going that long?
It's been going since the end of the 19th century, yeah.
Right.
And it started, it's a really beautiful story, actually, of these fusions of different styles of music that were in Rio at that time. So African and Caribbean drumming, and then Portuguese traditional music as well. And the different areas in the city would have pageants that would march, and then together they would kind of create these fusions of music, which were, you know, the drumming and the kind of more Portuguese traditional music. So that's how that grew. And then eventually there were samba competitions and samba schools, and now it's like an established thing that's still running. In India, there's the festival Holi, which has really kind of resonated. It resonated with the British when the British were in India. It's actually a celebration of the divine love of Radha Krishna, the triumph of good over evil. And that's been, it's been around since the 4th century
right.
BC, and that takes place in March. But I think, really, today's festivals as we know them, they hark back to those pagan kind of Nordic culture. So... I guess that makes sense. They started mostly in the 60s. The counterculture at the time, as it was gathering traction, it was, you know, it was kind of dissident, and I guess that the pagan rituals played into that, escaping to the countryside, all that kind of thing. And we see this kind of new festival culture emerging in the 60s. Actually, in America, it started a little bit earlier, because you've got the Newport
The Newport ones, there's a jazz...
1954, that starts.
That's the Newport Jazz Festival.
Yeah, 1954. Which makes sense, because the phenomenon of the teenager was in the States at that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then the Newport Folk Festival is famously where, and we've done a whole podcast about this, where Bob Dylan plugs in his guitar... And Pete Seeger goes nuts, doesn't he, and tries to chop the leads up with an axe when Dylan goes electric at the Newport Folk Festival in 64, I think it's 64, isn't it? Yeah.
Billie Holiday played at the Newport Jazz Festival in, it's Rhode Island that it takes place, still happens there. She played there in the 50s. Inspired by that, we started getting these festivals over here. So actually, the National Jazz and Blues Festival started in, it was Richmond, it was 1961, and that would later become the Reading Festival.
That's right, yeah.
So that's kind of the earliest festival that we have, like modern kind of pop festival.
Look up, it just shows how US-centric a lot of the history of pop culture is. Because if you look up online, if you Google for first pop festival, modern pop festival, it nearly always says Monterey Pop, 1967, Otis Redding, just before, well, a few years before Woodstock. And never mentions 61, Reading Festival began. No, an occasion where people can, having done their A-levels, go and set fire to each other's tents.
Yeah. Push the toilets over.
Push the toilets over and set fire to tents. It's a rite of passage now, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
While watching, I don't know, who would it be now? I'm trying to think who it would be right now. I'm worried about giving any reference in case it immediately shows how out of touch I am, and I'm sacked. You know. So, yeah.
I think Metallica played Leeds recently, didn't they? It's a big rock. It's become a big rock festival, hasn't it?
It was blues and jazz, wasn't it initially? Yeah. But no, it really is kind of rocky and sort of and teenage. It's very teenage now, isn't it? Yeah.
It was £1 to get in 1961.
Was it?
And Chris Barber performed, who's also popped up in previous Notables, hasn't he?
Yes.
He was in Lonnie Donegan's band. 1968 in this country, we get the Isle of Wight Festival.
Yeah, we're famously. Is that the one? Is it 60 or is it 68 or 70, the one where they encamp, where people set fire to things and go up on the hill?
Just looking nervous now.
And then, they break down the fences. And there's a lot of brilliant interaction from the stage, isn't there? Like one of the organisers is like doing all this great, oh, man, you're freaking us. The vibes here are not... Joni Mitchell famously says something like, why are you behaving like this? You're behaving like animals. I just want to play you my music. And then someone throws a bottle of wee at her or something like that.
Like Daphne and Celeste.
Yeah, so, can I digress briefly to tell you my Reading Festival story?
Yeah.
One of the first, when I was writing for the NME, they sent me to the Reading Festival. Now, here, this lovely evening we're going to have here, the evening spread before us that we're going to have, lovely music and food and the football and all that. The Reading Festival that I went to in the late 1980s, when I just started writing for the NME, I was a cub reporter for the NME. Oh, my God. It was just... I didn't go to Vietnam, obviously, but I imagine it was a bit... It was horrible. It was just horrible. Meatloaf, Bonnie Tyler. I'm not saying particularly anything about the music, but it was just grim. And then a ritual happens at 10 o'clock. All the Hell's Angels from the Thames Valley descend on the site. So you've got all these kids called Gandalf and Moonchild and things like this. And these Hell's Angels who are off their heads on cheap biker speed... And it's just grim. And I could not stick it any longer. So I said, I'm off. And we were driving back, I seem to remember. And the main band were Jefferson Starship, formerly Jefferson Airplane. Now, some of you might know that Jefferson Airplane played the infamous Altamont Rock Festival, which have you ever seen the Males Brothers documentary about? Let's hope we don't get an Altamont style, you know, happening tonight, hey? But which is a terrible thing that happens there, and the Stones play. But at one point in that, one of the Hell's Angels gets up on stage and punches Marty Balin of the Jefferson Airplane in the face, and they carry on playing the set with him lying unconscious on the stage. So I put in my review rather wittily, I thought, because I listened to Radio 1 were covering it live, and I listened to the set as I drove home, and I reviewed it having left, and I put in, Grace Slick was at Altamont, so she's not going to be fazed by some hippies from Reading. You know what I mean? She seemed real terrible. And 2 weeks later, a letter came into the NME, because that's how letters used to work then, you know, not an email. 2 weeks later, and a letter came in and said, "Loved Stuart McConey's review. One thing, though, Grace Slick left the Jefferson Starship 2 years ago." Which, of course, just listening to it on the radio, I didn't know.
She wasn't.
And the editor, and if it, any regular newspaper, that would have got you the sack straight away, but the editor just came to me and said, "Oh, hilarious, brilliant." As you were.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Sorry.
Yeah, where was I?
I was digressing.
Isle of Wight Festival.
Isle of Wight, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you were talking about the Isle of Wight Festival. It was in 1970. Over 600,000 people descended on the Isle of Wight, and afterwards they passed the Isle of Wight Act, which meant that gatherings of no more than 5,000 people could happen.
On the Isle of Wight or anywhere?
On the Isle of Wight. In Parliament. 1969, we get Woodstock.
Yep.
Also on a dairy farm.
Max Yazka's farm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The slogans of the local protesters are funny. Stop Maxi's Hippie Music Festival, which is just what it means.
Yeah, can't argue with that.
Buy No Milk was another one. Lots of people holding those placards. I don't know why.
Well, maybe they were trying to boycott Maxi's milk. You know, he was he took a real chance, Max Yazga, didn't he? He's a real cool guy. He said, "Come on, let's have this festival." And he wasn't a hippie or anything like that. Yeah. He just thought, "Hey, these kids should have a festival." Yeah.
The governor nearly sent troops to shut it down. Yeah. First Woodstock. And then 1970, we get Glastonbury, inspired by all these events. Oh, it was called the Pilton Festival, wasn't it?
It was.
But taking
it's like a mini Timber Glastonbury, if you've never been.
Timber's grown, though, hasn't it?
It's getting out of hand.
It is, yeah. It's like Coachella.
It's getting out of hand.
There's some really funny footage of Michael Eavis. It's BBC footage, but you can get it online. And he's being interviewed by the BBC reporter on the toilets that he's built for the festival. It's like a skeleton of the structure. He's just sitting there, and the BBC reporter's sitting next to him on the toilet and asking him why he's doing it. He's quite open, and he kind of says, "Because I'm in debt," and he wanted to clear his overdraft.
Yeah.
Famously, not many people turned up to the first one. T-Rex replaced the Kinks.
T-Rex replaced the Kinks at short notice. And apparently, Mark Bolan turned up in a huge Cadillac. And Michael Eavis said, "Oh, nice car," and put his hand on it. And Mark Bolan was like, "Don't touch my car, man. Don't touch my car." And was a real rock star, which you'd expect. But apparently was amazing. Apparently turned in an amazing set. Yeah.
Yeah. And then festival in the 80s, festivals go a little bit quiet.
Yep.
And then they come back in a big way in the 90s.
They do.
We have things like V-Fest pops up, don't we? Creamfields, I guess it was the free party thing that was that was an influence on that.
Well,
the rest is pretty much history, really.
Well, the thing is, people think that. People think, say, specifically about Glastonbury, that it's been going like forever, but it's not really. The 80s, it was intermittent. I mean, there were a couple of legendary 80s Glastonburys. There was 81, when the headliners were New Order and Hawkwind, joint headliners, and Barney from New Order, spends most of the last 20 minutes of the set lying on the floor because he's drunk a bottle of Pernod before they come on stage. And you think, do you know what? I have a sneaking admiration for that because it is so super choreographed now,
isn't
it?
Now,
and the lights and everything, which is great, okay. But there is something to be said for Barney lying on the floor while Hawkwind wait to come on, you know?
It's a bit more of a memorable story, isn't it?
Yeah, and then 86... Michael Eavis thinks that 86 is the year Glastonbury changed, when the Smiths played. It goes from being a hippie thing to an Indian alternative thing. And I think that's right. That's probably the turning point anyway, yeah.
Yeah, we're townies really, aren't we? We're not big festival people. Although we do love Timber.
We love Timber because we feel a kinship with Timber because we've been coming for... How long have we been coming here, Jeff? Have we been coming since it began?
Yeah,
Yeah, we've been to every one. So yeah, but we
almost as long as the
we go into a funny thing at Glastonbury, don't we? You and I,
yeah,
where we
so, yeah.
When people start going, oh, Dominic's lost his captain's hat. We go all northern. You know what I mean?
I think we were the only people eating doner meat and chips 1 year with curry sauce on it.
So anyway, so our notable exception.
I don't even like doner meat.
We have a notable exception in every podcast, and as we've forgotten to do it again.
Oh no!
Our notable exception can be Timber, which is the best fest. Jeff's got his head in his hands. Timber, which is obviously the best festival ever.
Yeah. And this is the biggest one yet. So that's notable exception, isn't it?
Well, you know what? We've just been talking to Rachel from the Unthanks backstage and Simon, who's just been chatting here. And everyone's saying that there's a real... Maybe I'll save this emotional speech till the end, I think.
Yeah,
let me take you back first to 1977. 1977, okay. The Voyager space programme. So it's intended to send a probe way out into interstellar space. There have been two before it called Pioneer. And on the sides of the Pioneer probes, they've put a plaque, a little plaque, saying, you know, we come in peace, and a drawing of a man and a woman, and et cetera, et cetera.
They were naked, weren't they?
They were
and people
naked.
People complained about that.
They were naked, and people complained about that. What they complained about was the fact they were naked, which is so odd, isn't it? You're worried about offending aliens millions of miles away in space.
Interstellar space.
But also what they complained about, rather more perhaps pertinently, is in the images, the man is waving and the woman has her hands by her side. Feminist campaigners, women, if that's the word I'm looking for, objected on the grounds that, quite rightly complained, on the grounds that it presented the man as the proactive sex, you know, doing the welcoming, while the woman just sat stood by. So that was one reason it attracted complaints as well. But yes, you're right, that was Pioneer. So in 77, there is this dude, some of you may know him, a guy called Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan, who, when I was a kid, I was obsessed with a TV series called Cosmos. Do you remember on the telly? Or as he put it, Cosmos. Because he used to talk of this really weird. He was like the Brian Cox of his day. So I was a bit of a nerdy kid, so I was obsessed with James Burke and Carl Sagan, who would take you on a voyage through the galaxy in Cosmos. And he had this idea we should send a record with Voyager. So they made a record. I'm going to refer to my phone in a minute because the exact contents are on my phone in case memory fails me. He said we should send something that tells them about our civilization, if should it ever be found. So they put on it an example of 55 human languages, beginning with a language called Akkadian, A, which was the first language we find any record of spoken in ancient Sumeria, the cradle of civilization, right up to a language called Wu, a modern Chinese dialect, or modern then back in 1977, to give the full spread of languages. They also included bird song.
Yeah, there's a baby. A mother kissing a baby.
A mother kissing a baby.
Yeah, that's how it ends.
Nick Sagan, Carl Sagan's son, who was then six, saying, hello, aliens.
Lots of music.
Lots.
Whale recordings.
Whale music. Artists, lots of music. And brilliantly, lots and lots of music. It isn't Western biased, really. It's lots of music from across the world, from civilizations all across the world. But of course, from my point of view, some of the most interesting stuff is what modern or what Western music did they choose to include? Your Bachs, your Mozarts, your Beethovens.
Interestingly, Tim Ferriss, who was one of the producers of the music side of it, he said part of the reason it kind of leans towards more Western classical music, and they included a lot of Bach and a lot of Beethoven, is because it's very mathematical. And he said that if extraterrestrial beings have their hearing is kind of, you know, different to ours, they hear different frequencies, or they can't quite hear music in the way that we can, they might understand mathematics. That he felt like that was a more universal language than
interesting.
The music.
So I guess a Bach fugue is more universal than Western pop, isn't it? I guess. I remember watching a program about this when I was a kid again, and there was a guy who used to be one of those public intellectuals you used to get, who was on the telly all the time, called Bernard Levin, and I remember him saying, I think the sending some bark is just showing off. Because this idea that the aliens would go, oh, our music's not as good as that, is it, Reg?
Because we wanted to play ourselves down, really, don't we, in space. Yeah. I mean,
they sent the Rite of Spring, which was,
Stravinsky,
I guess, as modern as it got, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which we've also done a podcast about.
We have,
The riot at the opening of the Rite of Spring. Let me just see what else I've got.
Chuck Berry was on there, and people complained about that as well.
They said putting Chuck Berry on was adolescent. And Carl Sagan brilliantly remarked, there are a lot of adolescents on the planet.
Yeah.
Which is a great riposte. Yeah. And it said we are not trying to show simply the culture of the bourgeois elite, if you like, but it's supposed to be the culture of all humanity, yeah.
They also tried to get John Lennon to help them compile it, didn't they? And he couldn't do it.
They did.
He had to leave the country. His reasons are dubious at best.
Really?
He had to leave the country, apparently, because of tax reasons.
Oh, well, he was probably at that time having a lot of trouble with the US authorities,
maybe,
because he was always getting deported, wasn't he, and trying to get a green card and things like that.
Yeah, because of Nobby...
Because of Nobby Pilcher, who we talked about in the last podcast. Yeah, refer back to that if you don't know.
So he instead put them in touch with Jimmy Iovine, who is a
big producer, produced Springsteen, he was a young kid producer then, produced a lot of big rock acts, and invented Beats International with Dr. Dre.
He did, yeah.
So, you know, he's still very much with us, and Jimmy Carter puts a message on the side. This is a present from a small, distant world, a token of our sounds, our science, our images, our music, our thoughts and our feelings. We are attempting to survive our time so we may live into yours. So, they send it off. It's a copper record, isn't it?
Gold-plated. And in aluminium-sealed cylinders. It's apparently the most durable thing we've ever made as a species.
Is it? That's amazing.
It's supposed to last a billion years.
Wow.
But Voyager, actually, their generator, the power generator, I mean, it's out in literally out in interstellar space.
Well,
but the generator's going to die in 2030.
2030, sorry, the generator will die, but it will still drift.
Yeah, it will.
But
yeah.
Maybe I'll come back in a minute. Blind Willie Johnson, some blues on there, Chuck Berry, Laurie Spiegel, the electronic composer, is brilliant.
Yeah.
Azerbaijani folk music. Yeah, Johnny B. Goode. They claim that rock music was adolescent. There's also Anne Druyan, who was the creative director of the project, an hour's worth of her brainwaves while she thought about things.
Yeah.
Just all this sort of stuff, that they thought was... Which is really good.
Did Carl Sagan... Did he actually believe in, you know, that there was life?
Yes. Sagan's
shtick. Because he was part of the UFO craze in the
70s. He's a cool guy, Sagan. Yes, he very much thought that it was... There had to be life. He was very much of the opinion that there had to be other sentient life out there in the vastness of space, yeah. And you're absolutely right. The power on Voyager will stop in about 2025, 2030, somewhere around then. But it will still drift. In 1990, it left Pluto behind. So it left our solar system behind then. It will next come into contact with a solar system with planets on it in 40,000 years' time.
Crazy.
Which is an amazing thought. 40,000 years from now, maybe someone's going to open up and listen to
Laurie Spiegel.
Listen to some Laurie Spiegel or Johnny B. Goode.
Chuck Berry. The radio waves that come back from it are travelling at the speed of light, but take 15 hours to reach the Earth. And they've had to increase the dish to...
Love that it's the most... I didn't know that. It's the most durable thing humankind has ever produced. That's amazing. In pop culture, it's been referenced a few times. It's in a couple of episodes of Star Trek. It's in an episode of The X-Files. It's in a comedy film from a couple of years ago where an alien couple called Dawn and Tad find it and stick it on their record player.
Steve Martin does a Saturday Night Live sketch, doesn't he, where the aliens find it and then they want more Chuck Berry.
Steve Martin plays a psychic who goes, "I'm getting the message from the aliens," and it's saying, "Send more Chuck Berry." Yeah. So I love the thought that right now, I'm not a scientist, but the galactic plasma, I think it's in some kind of weird nothing state in space at the moment between galaxies and between solar systems. But in 40,000 years, it will reach the next place and somebody might crack it open and play it.
Do you think they'll like us?
I think they'll like a right spring.
Yeah.
I think they'll go, "I can't believe they put all this Bach and Beethoven on it. Boring."
They might get here and hear all the modern pop and think, "What's this? We wouldn't have travelled all this way."
Another piece of modern art that it's referenced in is a play called The Greatest Play in the History of the World by Ian Kershaw, which is a one-person show that he wrote for his partner, Julie Hesman-Halch, who will be here on this stage tomorrow doing Wilderness Tracks with TV and Radio's Jeff Bird.
Notables Jeff Bird.
But for now, it's been so lovely being in a place like this again.
It has, yeah.
But that Simon and Rachel, I beg your pardon, from the Unthanks were saying that it's actually quite emotional just to be somewhere with people, hearing music, listening to people talk, all the stuff, wristbands, plastic glasses, all the stuff you never thought you'd get romantic about.
I know.
So great. So do, if you've not already done so, subscribe to Notable, like us, check out the previous 17, I'm told, and have a fantastic evening, and we'll see you about.
Yeah, thank you.
Notable,
the podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.